So as you know, Sufis are not great believers in rules. There's a saying, rules are for fools. So I have a request, not a rule. If you have a cell phone, turn it off, or at least turn the ringer off, please. That's as close as we'll come to a rule. Many religions and spiritual paths allude to death, but they really don't teach anything about it. Certainly our cousins, the Tibetans, do, and some other paths do. But there is a consistent roadmap which it might be very wise to learn while you're here, so that you can begin to prepare for that journey, which I assure you is inevitable. But the way that you are prepared is the way the journey will unfold. Some go completely unprepared, and it is akin to being tossed in an ocean. And not only do you not know how to swim, you never knew there were even oceans. And there is so much that we can experience about death before the actual end of our life that it's somewhat foolish not to do so. And as one begins to experience a real relationship with a condition that is different from this particular condition in some ways, then that awareness of death, or what we call death, becomes, in a sense, your greatest spiritual teacher. Just the acceptance of death becomes a teacher in itself, because then the moment that we're in has much greater value when you recognize its finite nature. And also the recognition of the finite nature of life leads to the infinite nature. And it is the interplay of the infinite and the finite, which is what we call God. Before I go on, how's the sound? Louder, and can we un-echo possibly? I suppose it's nice to think that one's words will echo on, but not today. Is that any better? Much better. Oh, you get good grades up there. Much better. And can you hear in the back? Yeah, good. So one of the great gifts of Sufism is the teachings on death. And the aspect that I appreciate so much is that the teachings continually change. So it is as if we have a map of a territory, and as we explore more and more of the territory, the nature of the map necessarily changes. And with Sufism, what's really so delightful is that the dimensionality of the map changes too. So it's not just that the picture on the two-dimensional map changes, but as you become more familiar with it, the entire topography changes, and it goes from a two-dimensional map to a three-dimensional map. And then, of course, it goes beyond that. And what's equally exciting is that even though the map is consistent, it is unique to each one of us. your experience of that will be unique. No one will experience death the way that you do, just as no one has experienced life exactly in the way that you do. And yet we can say there certainly are consistencies in our experiences of life. And yet we can also say, gee, if you compare certain lives with certain other lives, it's as if some people are living on the moon and some people are living as a microbe. You know, they're that different. And yet there are still consistencies. So what I hope to do in a very short period of time, in 2 hours and 2 days, is give you an introduction to the roadmap, enough so that you'll seek out the next step. And that's that would be enough. So where to begin, of course? Well, one begins with the mystical birth. And I'm sure this is perhaps heresy in this company, you know, but if Rumi was the child, Hafiz was the parent. So we'll begin with Hafiz. Hafiz, if you don't know, was a Persian poet, very, very unusual man. He had tremendous troubles in his life, usually of his own making. He would do all the wrong things. You know, he was, as he said, I was a very ugly person. Physically, I was a very ugly person. So what does one do when one's very ugly? One falls in love with the most unattainable woman in the town, which he did, the equivalent of the king's daughter. And he said, I then dedicated the next number of years into making this incredibly beautiful, perfect woman fall in love with this ugly man. And it would be fine if the story ended there, but then he said, and she actually fell in love with me, at which point I rejected her. And I don't know if you know the poem about the debtor sheikh. There was a sheikh who was always borrowing money from the Murids. Hafiz said, that poem is about me. And on it went. But he was quite the ecstatic, and even today, and this is not an exaggeration, Hafiz in Iran is read more widely than the Quran. And that's true. Once God made love to a great saint who had a hairy belly. Of course things like that can happen. And it was a surprise only to the novice on the path when the saint's stomach began to swell, just like a woman's. Weeks went by, then months. The saint's cheeks turned into beautiful roses. He became like a young bride who is carrying a holy child. And his gratitude was speechless. But his eyes shone like two planets making love. The town began to stand outside his house at night. For it had come to the attention of the faithful that as the moon passed by on its round, it would sometimes bend over and kiss his roof. Of course, things like that can happen. Life went on amidst the other 10,000 wonders, whiskers and weeds and trees and charming babies kept emerging. People and cattle and bees worked side by side, all sweetly humming, and come lunch, all dined on the same mysterious, divine manna of nourishing love, disguised in 1,000 shapes and colors and forms. Galaxies gave away their ingenious ideas and told us of their private bodily functions. So humans too eat, burp, and excrete more worlds. How is it that invisible thoughts can lift heavy matter and build cities and armies and altars? All contain a hidden strategy to be transformed again into divine music and love and light. All contain a hidden strategy to be transformed again into divine music and love and light. The sun rolls through the sky meadows every day, and a billion cells run to the top of a leaf to scream and applaud and smash things in their joy. Of course, things like that can happen. Rivers stay up all night and chant. Luminous fish jump out of the water, spitting emeralds at all talk of heaven being anywhere else but right here. Clouds pull each other's pants down and point and laugh. Oh, my dear, of course things like that can happen. For all is written within the mind. For all is written within the mind to help and instruct the dervish in dance and in romance and in prayer. The stars get clearly drunk and crazy at night and throw themselves across the sky. Only an insane being or compound is not going mad with excitement at the wonderful performance by God. And still, light stretches its arms open even more and shouts to you, because you are light's lover, to forget your harsh actions of the past and just dance and just dance. Look, angels and flowers are playing hooky in graveyards, laughing and rolling naked on the cool stones. Why go to sleep tonight exhausted from the folly of ignorance when even the beloved is drunk and is doing wonderful ecstatic somersaults and is giving wild lessons between the sheets and between God's handstands all up and down the tavern floor and ceiling. Indeed, indeed, things like that can happen. A few days before the delivery of God's baby, you remember the God's baby in the stomach of the hairy stomach of the great saint. A few days before the delivery of God's baby, the saint had to visit a city close by where few knew of him. He was walking unnoticed past a mosque, and the shouts of God's lovers happened to fill the air, calling, "Allah, Allah, where are you, beautiful one?" And the child in the womb of the master could not remain silent and shouted back in an astounding voice, "I am here! I am here, dear world!" The crowd in the mosque became frantic. And they picked up shoes and clubs and stones. You know what then happened. This story became quite grim. But the moon cannot hold a grudge. It still stops by some nights and leans over this gentle earth as over a crib, and gives a full wet kiss. For the moon knows that God is always amorous. God will never stop making love, for the truth has been divinely conceived deep within each one of us. O Hafiz, look at the splendor of God's grace. The sun has been planted in 1,000 furrows across every soul's brow. Of course, my dear, everything that God and I say can happen. Is our life and our death. We are that child. We are the people in the mosque. We are the moon. We are the angels. And as Pirzia said, once we no longer exist, we are that too. But more than any of the words, the state of your mind and heart as that poem was being read is the real teacher about death and about life. The energy, the presence that's just beyond the reach of our rational mind, but is still perceptible, like an aroma of a flower that you can't see at night. We smell it, we know it's there, and we imagine its form. The wisdom is here, in the atmosphere. It is our duty, our dharma. You all know the word dharma. It's the, you know, karma? Karma is cause and effect, basically. Karma is the line. You do this, then this. Dharma is the circle. Dharma is the completed line. No more cause and effect, just the continuity, the wisdom. Finding out this is our dharma. Why? Because we can. Because for whatever reason, or no reason at all, our worlds, our universes, have been created in such a way that we find ourselves able to be here, able to hear this, to see each other, to be a part of this moment. There are very beautiful people on planet Earth, but their life is full of struggle. And in order to survive, they cannot stop and appreciate the aroma, the smell, the perfume. Pirzia was talking about one of the aspects of prayer, which is gratefulness, thankfulness. It's not just saying, oh God, thank you, even though that's very helpful. But it's an awareness. Life has given me this special opportunity. Not to make us guilty and say, oh, I must do this because life has been good to me. Life, fortunately, is not business. But the awareness that we are getting a wonderful opportunity in life helps us to be more able to receive the teaching. Bless you. My mother, who has her own religion, is one of her tenets is about sneezing. And she says, pay attention when people sneeze as you speak, because it always means that you're telling the truth. That's why my mother likes to be around people with hay fever. But so we have this opportunity. And I think in that brief talk that Llewellyn gave last night, there's great wisdom. We didn't come here to get. And in a way, we didn't come here to give. Getting and giving both are an affirmation of a model that is a surface model. So why are we here? Well, all reasons would fall back into that paradigm of giving or getting, except for one, which is this state which the Western philosophers call the state of being. We came here to be, because being here collectively is different than being here alone. It's true that we're all connected in so many ways. It's equally true that there is one consciousness that is existent through us all. It is also true that each of us is a unique expression of that consciousness. And we're here to experience all those aspects, not to get them, just to be with them. So it's time, I guess, to put a little meat on the bone, as I'm going to try and do at least a 5-day seminar in 4 hours. And really, it takes about 50 years to go through the introduction. All of that being said, how did we get here? Where did we come from? What does it mean here? What does it mean not here? I was in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago and went through this as quickly as I thought I ever would. But that shows you that, what's the saying, man proposes and God disposes. Today we'll go through it even with greater rapidity, which means that we need to be present. But that doesn't mean awake. I mean this sincerely. I never mind if people fall asleep when I talk. I feel like there are certain things that are just too difficult to get with our mind yapping away. We don't have enough experience in deep meditation yet. So if you fall asleep, be my guest. My feelings won't be hurt, I promise you. And I give you complete permission, if you want to lie down on the floor and take your pillow, and it's okay with me. You'll get it just the same, because it's an energetic transmission. The words are just the covering. The first three levels of consciousness. Now take what you wish. Anything you don't agree with, just ignore. Don't sit there and fight it. It won't get you anywhere, or me either, for that matter. Just what resonates with you, take in. And what doesn't, just let it slide by. And if you were trained in a system where they say there's 5 levels or 9 levels, and I say 7, words, 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 we'll get buried under our differences. Don't waste time, there's not a lot of it. So, I'm going to use the word God because it's convenient. I know we each have our own definition of that. But it would take too long to get to a common definition. The world's been trying for a few millennia, hasn't even come close. So just believe whatever you wish to believe about that word God, and if you don't like that, just substitute another word. Most disagreements are at the semantic level. An infinite being with no self-consciousness, no awareness of itself, no beginning, no ending, no time, no non-time, no space, no non-space. No name, no non-name. An infinite being. Ever was, ever will be, always is. Unchangeable. Unbornable, undiable. And the most difficult part for all human beings, unknowable. We don't like to believe there's something we can't know. An infinite being, even the prophets, even these incredibly, uniquely realized women and men, affirmed that there is a place where no one can go. Now, we use our euphemistic minds to believe that God knows that place. God does not know that place. There is no knowing in that place. Now, somebody here should very wisely ask the question, and so I'll ask it for all of you, because I'm sure it will come to mind if it hasn't. Well, how can you possibly speak about or know about something that's unknowable? And of course, there is no answer that I can give except to say that there are things that we know, all of us, that we know because we know they're programmed into the human condition. It's interesting that the prophets attempted to go, to actually go to the places we know. It's enough for us to know them. They wanted to go there. I heard a wonderful thought about the idea that Jesus is the Son of God. And this person spoke this thought, and they said, of course, anyone who knows their parents is the child of that parent or those parents. But we are orphans. That doesn't mean we didn't have parents. Of course we had parents. You don't get here without parents. But we don't know our parents. So it's not that Jesus said, I'm the only child of God, or child of man, whichever you prefer. It's just that he knew. Abba, Father, is how he prayed. Abba. There are things that we know inherently as a human being. The word human comes from the Sanskrit word. I say this everywhere I go. Two Sanskrit words. The first word, which is found in most revealed languages used in religion for God in one way or another, is the sound or word hu. Hu, H-U. And the second is manas. Manas is Sanskrit for mind. Who is God? Manas is mind. God, mind. That's what a human is. That's the root of the word human. We know these things. It doesn't matter that we can't experience them. We know these things. So this first level, the Sufis call Ahadiyat. Ahadiyat. You don't have to know these words. It's completely unimportant. The words are Arabic. In that level, there is no awareness. This is not what we call God. We need a bit more personal relationship with God than that. It's fine. We create what we need. The second level. What do you think the second level would be if the first level is that? That's the third level. Semi-awareness, yes. The second level is existence. Not physical existence, no duality yet. The first level is the absolute. The second level is existence. But the interesting thing is, the reason why I said semi-conscious is because even though existence is, awareness of existence isn't yet. And then the third level is I exist. I exist. These are the three levels that are pretty far out there, pretty far away. At the same time, we individual human beings exist on all levels of consciousness simultaneously, as we'll see in a moment. So even though you don't have to remember this for a test, it is important to know that your consciousness is existing in the level of pure existence and in the level of I exist right now. Unfortunately, at least it appears so, unfortunately, the way consciousness works is, and for consciousness, I'm using, let's say, a combination of soul-spirit, which we'll talk about in a moment. Consciousness goes to the densest form. The densest form, because we're set up that way, is the human state, the physical state. Hence, we're conscious of the physical state. The other levels of consciousness we are not conscious of until we lessen the binds that consciousness has with the densest form. Now, this can happen in a number of different ways. One is you can get very sick, for example. And I don't know if you've ever had a high fever where you started to hallucinate or have a similar experience. All that means is the consciousness, because of the unusual change in your vibration of that moment, is able to experience the non-physical but formed condition as clearly as it experiences the physical. And hence you have what we call a hallucination. In meditation, we train ourselves to have consciousness withdraw from form. And then we begin to have experiences of lesser forms of form, which we'll go through in a moment, until we begin to have abstract experiences, because we're just withdrawing consciousness from the hold that the form has on it and allowing it to experience more subtle rates of vibration, all of which are occurring simultaneously with this moment right now. So you're not just sitting here seeing me. You are very, very definitely the unattainable vastness, the awareness of existence. Remember, existence has virtually nothing to do with physical existence, just existence, isness. And then you are experiencing the superego, the real I am. And from there, from that point, there is a great shift. Now, the shift occurs in each level of consciousness. There is a birth in each level of consciousness, so to speak. The great shift occurs after this third level. What happens there? The first three levels do not have form, do not have vibration. The first three levels are purely abstract. The fourth world is different. In the fourth world, if you imagine the first three as the sun, S-U-N, the fourth is the ray of the sun beginning to move out from it. Why this happens has been a topic that Sufis have discussed, it seems, eternally, because there always are Sufis. You know, somebody said, where did Sufism begin? And there's a wonderful saying of the Sufis that Sufism was a seed planted in the loins of Adam and Eve, watered in the time of, anybody want to guess? Noah. Sprouted in the time of Abraham. We say Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar, actually. The seed sprouted. Now, they only did the so-called Western prophets, because the person who wrote this only knew the Western prophets. It was written 1,500 years ago. Sprouted in the time of Abraham. Reached towards the sun in the time of Moses. Began to bear fruit in the time of Jesus. Gave wine in the time of Muhammad. Now, there's actually more in there, but that's enough to begin with. So the Sufis say this movement occurred primarily because of love, but not love that had any object. And another Sufi, who I think Pirzia spoke of this morning, Zulnun Misra, the Egyptian. He was this kind of wild man, old man, lived in the desert, and very difficult to understand, and his granddaughter was the one who fortunately could understand him and kept track of, wrote down what he said. And he said, no, it began because human beings existed as a potential in the loins of God. And God so loved human beings, even though they didn't exist, that all of this occurred out of that love. Now, if you misinterpret that, it becomes quite egocentric. But if you let that kind of fall into your heart, it will plant some beautiful seeds that will have resonance. So at that point, and at the godness became an activity, a movement. In the Bible it says what? In the beginning was the word. What does word mean? Well, it means vibration. It means movement. For mystics, it has a very special meaning. Before that, there was no word, there was only stillness. There was no direction, there was only stillness. There was only what we call the divine intelligence, which has not much to do with IQ, just the divine intelligence. Then there was this movement. But the interesting thing was the magnetism of this stillness was so impossibly powerful that the movement could just go to the edge of the stillness and was not aware of itself as moving. That state is what we would call in English the state of glorification. when one is only able to be aware of the vast luminosity of love. There are no lovers yet. You know, Mevlana says, the beloved is the all in all, the lover but a veil. There are no lovers yet. But somehow, at that point, when the infinite began to move, when time and space began to emerge, not as we know them, this time that I'm referring to, we would still call from our perspective infinite, because it's incomparable with our time. Now, the only way to take this is kind of like a mushroom trip. You just have to flow with it, you know? Don't understand it, or just don't get it. Just let it rip. So this glorification, which comes from, is rooted in the potential love for this divine mind, this humanus that each of us are a reflection of, at least, emerged and created this world of glorification. And in that world of glorification, which is so vast that it's incomparable to anything that we can imagine, but we can know it because it's in us, out of that emerged what we would call the angelic worlds. Now, this is not a world of beings with wings and with harps and with halos. Even though each of those is a symbol for, is a key for experiencing that world. And what do they mean in really simplistic terms? And I apologize, but take a ride anyway. You know, what are the wings? Well, the wings are a level of inspiration that has risen above the denseness of the worlds of cause and effect. The halo, what does the halo mean? The mind is pure light. The being is pure light. And the harp, the great secret, the harp is the mystical sound, the music, the symphony of the spheres, the effect of vibration. Those all manifest through the angelic worlds. Now, the great thing about the angels is that they're totally pure. They've just come from the thatness, so to speak. They are total purity, unaffected. Left alone, they would exist basically eternally in that state of glorification and purity. But something happens. That seed of love that pushed movement out of the vastness once again reemerges in a slightly different way. And it begins to push some few of these angelic rays. And they're not beings with form, they're vast vibrations. If you can imagine, it's not like this, but if you can imagine a vibration between here and Neptune, and instead of having millions of rises and falls, that vibration was one rise and one fall. That was it. That would be the beginning of an angel. You know, the Sufis, and the Zoroastrians too, I should add, talk about the angels, and they talk about first the angel of the earth. They say the whole of the earth is an angel. And then they say, but that angel is really the part of an angel. And that this solar system is really the angel. And then they say, but of course that solar system is really only the breath of an angel. Only really a dust particle of an angel. And so then you go on and you can imagine it gets pretty exciting on one level.
Well, somehow these angels begin this movement away from the center.
Now, this is not literally true. There is no center of the universe or universes, but it's the only way we can speak about it with words. So the angels, the vibrations, begin to move, some few of them, for reasons that are in that poem, but not in any textbook about Sufism that I've ever seen, let's say that. I should mention the book Hikmat al-Ishraq. It's translated into English. The Worlds of Light. And it was written by a young Sufi named Shahabuddin Sarwardi. And there were two Shahabuddin Sarwardis, the uncle and the nephew. The uncle is Umar Shahabuddin Sarwardi. The nephew is Shahabuddin Sarwardi Maktul. Maktul means he who was sacrificed, martyred. They killed him, the Orthodox, the ulama. And they killed him in a terrible way when he was 36 years old. Why? He was a brilliant being. He saw worlds of light. And he spoke what he saw. And so one day he said, if Allah wishes, Allah can create another prophet. And they said, no, because the Prophet Muhammad said, I am the seal of the prophets, I am the last prophet. And Shahabuddin playfully said, yes, but if Allah wishes, he could create another prophet. And the Orthodox said, no, getting a little huffy about it all. No, no, the Prophet said he was the last of the prophets, which is not exactly what he said. He said he was the seal of the prophets. And Shahabuddin Sarwardi, being a young, playful man, said, yes, but you cannot tell Allah what Allah can and cannot do. And they had no answer for him. So they peeled off his skin and just destroyed him. Anyway, he wrote about the worlds of light. An incredible book. Don't think that you're going to sit down and read it in one night. If you do a page a month, you'll be doing fine. It's pretty rich. But he was trained as a Zoroastrian. And he knew about the worlds of light and wrote about them. So there's movement through this worlds of light. There's the dawning of form as we know it. And I said, if the world was left pure, everything would have remained in a world of glory with no change. But I'm going to jump ahead in the story for just a moment. The angels move from this virtually formless world by going through an incredible birth process into a world of form. Not the human form, but a world of form. This is what the Sufis call the world, or the worlds of the jinn. There are thousands of layers to this world, beginning with the almost incredibly abstract worlds of music and sound, poetry, all the way down to what we like to call the astral plane or the psychic plane, the dark worlds, the worlds that are, in a sense, more dense than the human condition. Now you see why I said you could take the whole thing sleeping. It's probably better if you do. But as we go back, as we make the return journey, we need to deposit back in every world that substance which we've taken from that world before we can go on to a world of lesser substance. So in each world that we exist in, we then cover ourselves with a denser world, which is the next one, and denser and denser and denser and denser. Consciousness, as I said, is always drawn towards the densest.
So we believe we are a human being. We are this physical being, because that's how consciousness is drawn. And we need to lessen, one way or another, the hold of the physical world in order to experience these lighter realms, or in some cases, darker realms, but not denser. So fear, for example, can provoke a nightmare, which can seem to be even more real than this world. But there is still the awareness that I will wake up at some level of consciousness. In each world, we give back the substance of that world. So when we die here, on this planet, on this plane, I should say, we will give back to Earth that which we've taken from the Earth. And as Pirzia said, each of the worlds is made up of these four elements, which come out of the fifth: earth, water, fire, and air. When we die here, we give back the earth, the water, the fire, and the air, which we've pulled together to make this vehicle, this temple of God, where we're able to experience life on Earth. Our body, with the exception of the cosmic energy we get from the sun and the stars, our body is made up of the elements of planet Earth. It's not from some foreign planets, unless maybe you have a bit of meteorite in you, I don't know. But for the most part, our body is made up of this, of the stuff that we see out there, or this. That's what our body is. You know, it's made up of the chemicals that went into the plants we eat. It's made up of the fish or the meat, if you eat that, or the pesticides you ingest. It's made up of the pollutants of the air you breathe, and that's what our body's made up. It's not a mystery where it comes from. And this stuff of the body can be divided into these four natures: the earth, the water, the fire, the air. Each of them has a speed, a rate of vibration. What's the fastest element of the four? Yeah, be brave. So if worse comes to worse, you'd be wrong. Air. Now that should tell you what the second fastest is. Fire. Third. Fourth. Earth. When you die, what happens to the body? What goes first? The breath, the air. You die. At least I hope you die in an out-breath. The air is gone. What happens next to the body? Somebody said it. It gets cold, the fire goes. Within hours, some cases sooner, the body cools off. What happens next? The water leaves slowly. The body dehydrates. And then the slowest rate of vibration, the bones, the earth.